This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh. And the morning run begins. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. So join the conversation at any point in time. You can always WhatsApp us or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Joyce, it is a Wednesday because it's the middle of the week.
It is.
Reason to rejoice for some. But for others, it's a time to take stock of what you need to complete by the time you get to Friday,
right.
Isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, now, as you slept, several things took place around the world. Some of it in our own backyard. That's worth kind of reporting or just reminding everybody of. Singapore is due for a cabinet reshuffle, it says, which is set to take place after Parliament takes a midterm break. The essential message that was given by the Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, was that this was a chance for renewal, succession. But the question is, will power structures ever change in PAP-dominated Singapore?
Yeah, well, but it's good that they're talking about it. They're talking about succession and the topic has come up. They're having this conversation rather than to ignore it and totally not have this conversation at all. I remember in January, the Prime Minister did say that cabinet reshuffle will be a significant step in exposing new team leaders. But then he also says that he does not plan to appoint new deputy PMs.
Right. So this is what he refers to as the fourth generation. What is interesting is that, if you watch PAP government over the last couple of decades, you'd know that, succession is always there on the agenda. But as Lee Kuan Yew was then Prime Minister, did these processes of succession and renewal,
true.
He remained on the top.
That's
it's
true.
Just that his peers got removed and younger men and women, formed the cohort around him.
So but that's not just in Singapore. I mean, it happens everywhere else, not just in political parties. It also happens in corporations where the old guards can't let go.
Right.
It happens.
Well, so they get renewal at some level.
At different levels yeah, right? But at the top, it stays the same.
Yeah, and then what happens, of course, is then they're without peers. So they get to a very lonely spot at the top where nobody can speak directly to them, be honest with them. And they're surrounded essentially by younger people who will defer to them endlessly because they have none of the same experiences
that
started the whole process. Interesting. Anyway, we'll keep a lookout for what happens in Singapore once that cabinet reshuffle and discern the meaning in the tea leaves. Also, across the Straits of Malacca, two Christians were publicly flogged in Aceh for playing children's entertainment games seen as violating Islamic law. Now, of course, many people, we've had the news coming out from Aceh for, years now of people being flogged publicly. I thought what is really interesting in this, Joyce, is that apparently in the report, two dozen Malaysians were part of the 300 or so cheering crowd who not only cheered but also mocked those individuals who were being flogged. And I wonder if this is a new form of tourism that Malaysians are taking up, basically going off to different parts of the world where they can observe all kinds of interesting forms of punishment. If you remember the ISIS, the young men who joined ISIS in Syria and Iraq, who took selfies as somebody was having their head, throat slit behind them.
Oh dear!
Such gruesome stuff for some people. Entertainment for others. Also in the news, U.S. President Donald Trump has picked one of his political strategists as campaign manager for his 2020 re-election campaign. It could be, Joyce, 8 years of Donald Trump.
This is for his digital campaign, I think they're looking at. Well, yeah, we'll have to see.
Yeah, so, he is going to be, I think he is the man now, or was in charge of the digital campaign. He's going to be the campaign manager.
Right.
So I see it as very significant. Mm. We'll be back with a look at something I know nothing about. But Joyce, you have a special insight into pregnancy. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Stuck in the Middle with You by Steeler's Wheel, a Scottish folk rock band established in 1972. I was just 6 years old. I was apparently established by two school friends, Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty.
Interesting. Right,
this was one of their biggest hits. Fabulous song. Nice ditty to start off. Okay, we were talking about something I have never experienced. unlikely ever to experience, despite the advancements in modern science, and especially in medical sciences, but that you have already, encountered, experienced, I don't know what the word is, depending on how mawkish and sentimental you want to get, which is pregnancy. But apparently, Joyce, pregnancy can also be correlated to economic recessions.
That's right, Sharad. So the U.S. National Bureau of Economic Research published a report concluding that a falling conception rate in the U.S. has consistently preceded the economic downturns of the last three decades. Can you imagine that? So in a way, what they're saying is that there could be a correlation between pregnancy rates and downturns.
Okay, so is it that couples recognize that something is in the air? They sense that maybe the economy is not so well, so they postpone having a child. I mean, because it's a 9-month gestation period, right, between conception and having a child.
Yes,
and and the question is, and what scale? I mean, how many people actually are so tuned in? Is it a reason thought through a decision to withhold getting pregnant, or is it more like just the general state of things that makes them tend not to have children?
Perhaps it's just more, it's current data. So what the couple is going through at like right now, I think we were having a discussion about this outside the newsroom earlier, and we're saying that like economic data is it lags in a way, right?
Right. Whereas, because you only get it after the fact. After
correct.
The,
There's a time lag to economic data. So whereas for family decisions, it could be current, like when the husband and wife, their current work situation, how confident they are, whether or not they still have their job 6 months down the line. Are they looking to switch jobs because the job is not paying enough? You know, all these decisions, and they're like whether or not to have a kid or another kid in a way. So this research shows that, there could be a time lag when it comes to economic data versus family decisions. And
okay, but the question, I guess, is what pregnancy is one issue, having the baby 9 months later. So mm-hmm. How does anybody even gather this information about
exactly.
pregnancy until you have a falling rate of births?
They just
right?
noticed this. This is what they're saying. They just realized this, that the rate of women becoming pregnant begins to fall several months before the start of a recession. That is what this research data is showing. And its authors said that fertility rates might actually help to predict economic downturns. And they were more accurate than some traditional indicators. That's what they're saying, because economists are usually they're criticized for failing to accurately predict direction of economic growth because they're looking at, things like manufacturing output, retail spending, house prices, But actually what they're saying is that they should be looking beyond traditional measures and maybe look at pregnancy rates.
Well, if you ever been involved in a pregnancy, either having one directly yourself or been party to a pregnancy, tell us what you think. You can join this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Has your decision to have a baby been determined in part, a good part or large part, by the economic situation that you're sensing around you?
Of your household as well, your direct household,
right.
Or maybe just your friends or your current work situation. You're not just looking at macroeconomic data, the big data that's coming out from everywhere else. It's your own current direct data, right? Your own current situation. Yeah, I mean, looking at the study.
I don't know how many people actually do look at macroeconomic data
child. Yeah, so they said this is the first study to reveal that fertility rates were actually predictive of economic downturns.
So, okay, so what goes into the minds of young people, especially when they're having their first child? Do they think, is the question, can we afford to have a child?
Yeah, I think that it's a very real question that people talk about.
Is it the first one? Is it the
main
one?
It's not the first one. It depends on the couple, but I'm sure that will definitely come up. You have to think about so many things, from how the expenses and your responsibility as a parent to the child. I mean, that is, of course, there are a lot, it comes to emotional responsibility, your parenting responsibility, financing responsibility. There are so many, as a parent, you have a lot of things to take on, right? So I'm sure affordability of a child, how many children can you afford? I mean, that will definitely come
for
up.
For your sanity especially. Now tell us what you think. Remember, you can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with a look at moral suasion. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was 1234 by Feist. She's a Canadian indie pop singer whose first name is Leslie. Leslie Feist. Interesting. Okay. Interesting song. Let's talk about, there's a lot of misery around the world. Syria continues to provide us headlines that perhaps even numb us, I think, at some level. The Rohingya situation, you know, after close to 1 million people fled across the borders into Bangladesh, that's also been a situation that's, you know, that you can call quite clearly a kind of hell on earth. And then people, of course, who have tried to get the people who are the stakeholders, especially those who are pulling the levers of power, to do something about it. Not all of them have a direct or material control over these individuals. They use what I think we can call moral suasion. They appeal to them, their common humanity, their good sense, the fact that, you know, there is something larger, as it were. But do these gestures make any sense in the face of those realities? When you read headlines like the one that's just come out about three Nobel laureate winners who are going to touring Rohingya camps in Bangladesh now, who are saying to Aung San Suu Kyi, who is in fact in many ways the one of the prime movers in Myanmar's politics today, say, their message to her is wake up or face prosecution for genocide. They are appealing to her. Do you get cynical when you read headlines like that, Joyce?
Well, sure. I think in a way they're just trying to create awareness. They're hoping that, you know, in a way when they're visiting, it will create headlines as it has. And, you know, as you mentioned, moral suasion, hopefully influence some people to do what they're hoping they will do, right? But I'm not so sure whether or not it is effective. It depends on the situation. And
how sensitive perhaps different governments are to a bad headline, for instance. So a bad headline or a headline like this, which is in some sense a negative, right? Because it reflects badly on the Aung San Suu Kyi government.
But this is not the first time a bad headline has come up from that, right?
Absolutely.
And they have not budged at all.
So why do you think that leaders like this continue to engage in these gestures?
Maybe they think they're the ones who can make the change.
You think that they will be the tipping point?
Correct.
After all that's been said,
yes.
Similar perhaps,
yes.
That when they say it,
yes.
Something is going
they
to
think
snap.
That they'll be the person to change the situation. It's the same as like a girl going out with, you know, the guy is not good for you, but she thinks, oh, I'm going to be the girl to change the guy. You know what I mean? So maybe they think that in this situation, they hope that they'll be able to make that change. They'll be able to have enough clout to cause a positive impact or something. Because they went down to the ground. I think three of them went down to the ground and they said that they saw firsthand the situation and they're sharing what they've experienced and they're hoping that that will create awareness and bring about some change. And well, it has had headlines, but whether or not anything will come out of that, time will tell.
You know, I wonder if, you know, in many ways, this is as much about, you know, the message being directed at Aung San Suu Kyi with the hope that she will do something, if in fact she is in the position to do something, or this is about giving support to those who are, in a sense, her victims.
Yeah, creating awareness. That definitely.
Well, not awareness. I mean, this is meaning people who already know because they are the Rohingya themselves.
Yes.
It's about saying, well, you're in solidarity with me. So these three women there, Nobel Prize winners, saying, we know your pain and we will appeal. We will speak with you to Aung San Suu Kyi. And we remember, you know, many Muslim Myanmar people supported the National you know, the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party. The Rohingya are only one small part of the larger Muslim community, but who have also been demonized. But, you know, I'm sure they had hoped that Aung San Suu Kyi would do something positive for the community.
Right.
I mean, this is a problem that's decades old.
Yes.
You know, but so are we left with that? I mean, after a while, are we to be immune? I mean, if you were a person in a refugee camp and you heard this yet again, another Nobel Prize winner come through, what would you say to them?
Well, but it really depends on the person. I mean, some might be hopeful. You know, another, oh, someone's come to come talk to us again. Maybe this will be the person to cause the change. You know, some might be jaded. I mean, you can't blame them. It's been ongoing, as you mentioned, for so long. And yet, you know, the situation is what it is today, right? So it really depends. But hopefully someone will be able to make that change.
Yeah, I think that's some, you know, we all have our fingers crossed. But I must say, I'm deeply cynical. I mean, just look beyond, you know, the Rohingya situation, where in some sense this particular refugee crisis is fairly new. But if you look at the Syrian situation, boy, there is really nothing to say for, you know, humanity there. Okay, speaking of humanity, we have Human League taking us up to the first bulletin of the morning. Stay tuned with BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Carnival by the Swedish rock band The Cardigans. Back to Malaysia, all the way from that side of the world, Sweden that is, to a very hot topic, the question of Niloufar. She has, over the years, courted some controversy, but she's also been a huge, huge success financially with her line of products and her marketing strategies. Now, the latest of which was to have this, as everybody knows, product lunch at Zouk, which is, of course, is a well-known nightclub downtown Kuala Lumpur. It's, of course, been the target of many people who think that it was misplaced, that she shouldn't have been there, that the product shouldn't have been there, and this was somehow insulting and offended some people. Now, others are saying it's a great thing. She, on the other hand, says, I'm not listening to my haters. I do what I think is right, and I think I've done it in the right way, and I'm going to carry on.
That's right, Sharad. I think she said, Niloufar said that she picked the venue because of budget as well. She said if she has chosen anywhere else, she might have to fork out extra budget. So there's a reason behind why she did that.
Yeah, but it's not
That's
just cheap,
one.
Right? I mean, it's also cheap with a certain class, because you can go really cheap in the city. You don't have to go to super cheap.
She picked the venue as well because it suited the theme of the event. I think that's what she mentioned to the press when this news started coming up. So, I mean, there'll be definitely haters going to hate in a way, that's one. But also, different people have different opinions. One of them is that because of the situation, the launch of a hijab, I think a new launch, and you're saying that to have it in a nightclub, it's not a suitable venue.
And I guess people also, you know, Joyce, that some people will say, and hijab is, in some sense, it helps you conform to religious expectations of covering yourself, but it's also a fashion a statement. And, you know, in many ways, the whole hijab industry has gone beyond the mere functionality of shutting, you know, a view of parts of your body into something that is a statement about your personality, through the colors, through the design, to the use of it as
well. But people still link it back to religion in a way, right? So what you're saying is that Muslim women and women who wear hijab, in, you know, they shouldn't be in vice areas. They view Zouk as a vice area. But I guess where Niloufar is coming from is that I'm just having an event there. They're not doing anything that is against the religion.
As she interprets it, right? So we have a poll out now. We focus actually on the business angle on this. And we ask, was her product launch at Zouk ultimately a business success? Hashtag tell BFM. What do you think? At the moment, 18% say, no, it wasn't. 20% now, sorry. We just jumped 27% say no. And 73% say, yes, it was a business
success. She sold out, apparently. That whole launch of the new product at Zouk sold out.
Right. So there's success in the immediate launch. That might have been a success. But what about the long-term issue? Is she going to suffer some sort of reputational damage as a consequence of this choice of hers, of doing the launch at a nightclub?
It depends on the person and her fans, her fan base. If you check her Instagram, I mean, she has like 5.5 million followers on her Instagram. You can see from some comments, I mean, she's getting a lot of support, and there are others who say, oh, I'm disappointed in you, I'm going to stop following you. So, you know, you get a mixed bag there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think a part of the what makes this interesting is that her products are not being sold just as for themselves, right? For their quality or for their cut or whatever. It's also as an attachment to her as a person.
Yeah, the personality.
And yeah, she's weathered many storms before. If you remember, I think it was a year or so ago, she sold, because she sells much of her products online, mm-hmm, to somebody who lives in the state of Israel, a Muslim woman who bought her hijab and was very thankful and sent her a note. And she proudly displayed this thank you note to her fans through her Instagram or one of her social media platforms. And then she was pilloried for doing business with somebody and tacitly accepting the existence of the state of Israel. And it really did open up a huge question as to what was she really doing?
That caused headlines as well, right?
It did cause headlines, right? And then, because you had to say, well, she's serving the Muslim community of the state of Israel. I mean, they are Arab Muslims, as they are Arab Christians in the state of Israel, who are, you know. And should they also be ignored in our denial of the state of Israel? And so a lot of questions came up. You could see the potential damage to her.
Yeah, but she still has 5.5 million followers on Instagram, right?
Maybe came down from somewhere. But was this savvy? Did she, and is it possible that she thought this through? That she thought that it might be controversy, and that controversy is good?
Yeah, and coming back to Zouk, I mean, that's the point of discussion today, right? That she had it in Zouk, and that's viewed as like an entertainment. It's a nightclub, right? But it's also a venue where people have launches and events when it's not a nightclub. But I guess people still, there's the notion of, well, because it serves alcohol and all that. But it depends
absolutely
on your view on the venue. And also, I guess in this situation, it's also the product, what she's selling, and her personality, what she portrays.
Right.
So, yeah.
And in all instances, there are multiple interpretations that have been given for all of these things. The venue, the product, the person, and our responses to it. We'll be back with a look at another controversy. But don't stop tweeting in your responses. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Something Good Can Work by Two Door Cinema Club, a Northern Irish band from County Down. Nice dance music
for the morning.
We're talking about controversy. We're not going to stop talking about controversy. We can still talk of the controversy we just talked about, which, of course, is the product launch by Niloufar of her, I think, a line of turbans and that she did at Zouk. We have a poll out, and you can still join that poll. We ask it the question, do you think this has been a business success? So this launch has been a business success.
What's the result so far, Sharat?
Well, it looks like it's sort of 70-30. Okay. 70% going with yes, it's a success. 30 saying no, it's not a success. I'd like to know from both sides why they think, why you think it is a success or not a success, as the case may be. Do you think there's going to be long-term reputational damage for Niloufar?
Yes, tell us.
And remember, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, be part of this conversation at any point in time this morning, all the way up to 10 o'clock, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we'll come back to another controversy that's been raging for some days now. This has to do with the Hong Kong-based tycoon, Robert Kwok, a Malaysian, of course, of Malaysian origin, whose reputation is staggering, at least in the landscape of Malaysian business and economy. Now, he is attacked after an article came out that suggested that he was funding the Democratic Action Party, or the DAP. And quite a number of politicians jumped on that bandwagon, attacked him. And now we can speak about it also, how the Prime Minister seems to have shifted his tone a little bit in terms of responding to that story. But I wonder why, was this even necessary? I mean, why did this even emerge as a controversy? After all, the source of the story is not particularly well known as a source of reliable news.
Yeah, whether or not that piece of news is correct and factual, right? Yeah.
I mean, first of all, why would politicians jump on a story like that?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the humongous reputation of Robert Kwok.
Mm-hmm. And what he has achieved, how far he's come.
And then to insult him in the most puerile and, adolescent of ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
To call him names and tell him to come back and, we'll, you know, do battle in the electoral field. And using that, nasty honorific, sorry, not honorific, the nasty term used in Malay to describe effeminate men, which is part of the, I think, the discourse of masculinity, apparently, kejantanan, which, really grips some politicians in this country.
Mm.
Why was it even necessary?
Yeah. He's 94 and he's done so much. And if you read his book, I've read his book. Have you read his book, Sharad?
No, I haven't actually.
It's interesting. I mean, he shares a lot. I mean, he's actually a very private man. You know, to get an interview with him, he seldom comes out to share the story. So I think when the books hit the stands, everyone wanted to read it because you want to know what is his story in a way. And he shares from his childhood days all the way until right now in a way. So he shares of his stories with his mom, growing up with his brothers. And yeah, it's a
Did
bit...
Did you find it fascinating read?
I found it very interesting. So it's I'm not sure, as you mentioned, it's everyone's questioning like what's happening, why are they attacking him,
and one explanation I think Joyce has been given, mm-hmm, is that this is about the upcoming general election. This is about G14. Essentially, this is about politics. And quite a number of, or at least one academic, Associate Professor Awang Azman of University of Malaya, said that UMNO is in panic mode. I mean, he's saying, he names the party specifically and says it's in panic mode. And he says, and I quote him, "It is as though they would rather believe the words of an exiled blogger who's made these allegations with no supporting evidence whatsoever, rather than, go on the reputation of the man, Robert Kwok." Was it really about hitting out at Robert Kwok, or was it about messaging the ground? And I think that's also where the analysts are taking it.
Right.
It's really about saying, I'm going to champion our community, this nation, against those who are treacherous and who would betray us and such and such.
But if you read his book, you can see he does love Malaysia.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the decisions he has made. One of them was to be chairman of Malaysia and Singapore Airlines. At that time, he was invited to be chairman of that. And one of the reasons was because they told him that it would preserve ties between Malaysia and Singapore.
Yeah. And also in the book, I believe, because it's also kind of quote, these pictures of snapshots of pages from the book are also circulating, that he says that in the early days, just after independence, that he was asked for donations for two very specific parties, which he gave freely and willingly. And that was UMNO and MCA. So the irony is that when he does admit to giving money to political parties, it's actually from the ruling coalition.
Mm.
And then, of course, it goes back to the whole question, I think, that some people ask is, what's wrong with giving money to the DAP? I mean, it is a political, a legitimate legal party on the political landscape, and anybody can give donations to those parties. But it's the projection of these nefarious, evil mastermind, pulling strings from abroad,
correct,
kind of narrative.
That's
really interesting.
And there's also this story about him apparently funding the Malaysian Insight and media portals or something like that. So like you see, back to that narrative, which I think his office has come out to deny. But it's interesting, if you read in his book, he also shares about how he sold South China Morning Post. He used to own that. And he actually said, when people ask him, how do you feel after selling it? And he said in one sentence, in a word, few. Like, you know, like, just,
oh, relief,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah,
relief,
correct, right? So you see that he actually had no regrets leaving the media business in a way. So, yeah.
It is curious, and may say more about our politics and our politicians than it ever say about Robert Kwok. Taking us up to the next bulletin this morning, Pat Banatar with Hit Me With Your Best Shot. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh, and the morning run continues. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Recently, Joyce, the president of the Malaysian Council of Former Elected Representatives. I don't know if you've ever heard of this organization. I certainly haven't.
This is my first time.
Your first. Well, many of us, perhaps. Anyway, his name is Abdul Aziz Rahman. He was in Indonesia for a visit and was struck by the Pancasila, which in many ways resembles our Rukun Negara. It's a kind of statement of beliefs, or you know, of philosophy of a country.
Okay.
Now, Abdul Aziz also went on to say that while Malaysia and Indonesia had very similar principles, he felt that Indonesia was more advanced in terms of its ability to adhere to those principles and achieve unity. Do you think that the Rukun Negara has played a very big part in your life? I mean, apart from being on the back of textbooks or on the exercise books.
I remember reciting it at assembly every Monday at school. Yeah, I mean, you say it every Monday when we line up, sing Negaraku, say the Rukun Negara, sing the school song, the state song. Yeah.
And many countries have things like that. I mean, Myanmar has as well a statement of, you know, the nation state ideology, and it's printed in everything. Mm-hmm. Every, you know, piece of every book, well, even if it's got nothing to do with the subject matter, that's there on the book. The question is, does it actually change people's heart? Does it affect the way they conduct themselves with each other? You know, it's a very interesting question. Yet a lot of countries put effort into creating something like a Pancasila or recreating something like a Rukun Negara. Now, to understand more about the Pancasila, we spoke to Bun Negara, the senior fellow at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, and asked him to share his views on whether or not the Pancasila has played as big a role in uniting Indonesia as it's claimed.
Well, when the Pancasila was first, you know, proposed back in the 40s, you know, it was actually an attempt to, in a sense, unite the Indonesian nation and so on. But, you know, there have been doubts as to how effective it has been or whether it has been effective at all, because very often little attention has been paid to it when larger self-interests are at play. So what is more important, I think, for us to consider is whether the Pancasila in modern Indonesia, that is going back to, you know, more recent times, going back, say, a couple of decades, whether it has been productive for Indonesia. Internally, I think that is really very much an open question, and analysts have got very different views about it. The mainstream views that have been shared by a number of Westerners is that, you know, Pancasila has been positive, and that, you know, there's no critical analysis of it at all. But in more recent years, there has been research that has found that the Pancasila has in fact not been that good for Indonesia, but in fact it may have been created more recent problems.
Now, we asked Bun to elucidate on those problems.
For example, it has served as a possible platform for greater authoritarianism by the state, as well as you know, failing to hold back any urges or surges of extremism, whether religious, ethnic, or whichever. And we have seen that, you know, these developments have been taking place in recent years. So the Pancasila has been paid lip service to, and when it has been used, it has been used for vested interest to advance the selfish self-interest of particular quarters, whether in government or in certain groups like some religious and ethnic groups. So we have to be very careful in how this has been seen. Internationally, I think the Panchasila has got a more positive impact in the sense of, paving the way, as some say, for the five principles of peaceful coexistence between China and India. So it has been said that, the leaders of China and India going back to the 1950s had, taken some inspiration from the Panchasila to have more positive relations between the two countries. But internally, I think whether for Indonesia or other countries such as Malaysia, I think we have to be very careful because we have to be aware of the more recent studies that have been done and also some of the problems that are associated with it.
So the Rukun Negara has been compared to the Panchasila, but we asked Boon for his thoughts on the call by Abdul Aziz Rahman, president of the Malaysian Council for formerly elected representatives, for us to emulate Indonesia and the Panchasila to give us greater unity?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, every country is different, and Malaysia has got the Rukun Negara and so on. So I think there have been some debate about this, whether we should follow Indonesia's example. Actually, we should follow our own example. We can learn from other countries, both the positive and the negatives, what they have done right, what they have done wrong, countries from just about anywhere. But I think in the end, we have to see how our society fits and whether it fits our society. Because if you compare just two countries, Indonesia and Malaysia, although we are close neighbors, Malaysia and Indonesia have important differences as well. For example, Malaysia is a much more multiracial, multicultural, multi-ethnic society where minorities are relatively large, and we have to take into account their various interests as well. So in terms of legitimate and constitutional interests, I think we have to protect them of whichever group. But we should also at the same time be careful that, no instrument is being allowed or used by any extremist group to advance their very narrow agenda. So I think with the Panchasila coming into question in Indonesia lately, I think we have to be also very careful about what we do here in Malaysia.
That was Boon Negara, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, sharing his thoughts on the proposal that we emulate Indonesia more closely in the way that it adheres to the Panchasila, the principles of the nation state there.
It is quite similar to our Rukun Negara in a way, no? If looking at the principles, it's very similar.
Yeah. Unity in diversity and such. And I think what is also fascinating from a Malaysian perspective is Indonesia is a republic. Two, it's secular and for the most part has defended its secular basis. Despite having majority Muslim population larger than Malaysia. So, the Muslim population in Malaysia, perhaps 60%, in Indonesia, more than 80%. And yet, they're a secular nation, and the politics has proceeded from that. But of course, there are challenges today to those kinds of assumptions. Absolutely. Tell us what you think the Rukun Negara has meant to you, especially growing up. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.